History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. One thing we've learned is that they really don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, then have the patience to listen as long-buried memories start to rise to the surface. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And speaking of inspiration, our hope has always been that while you glean a little of all of those things and a whole lot of perspective from the veterans you hear on this program, that it might also motivate you to connect with the veterans in your life and allow them to dust off some of their memories. Veterans Day this past Thursday really brought that home, as I saw so many of you post on social media about the veterans in your life. When it comes to our World War II generation, the VA estimates that out of the 16 million Americans in uniform during that period, a little more than 200,000 are still with us. If you have the chance to record a World War II veteran story, I encourage you to submit it to a new organization called Remember World War II. You can learn more at rememberww2.org. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But some friends of mine who've been honoring veterans for years have launched this new initiative with the hopes of capturing as many World War II vets' stories as possible in these last few years we have with our greatest generation. You can really make a big difference on multiple levels, and on top of that, satisfaction and fulfillment, you could even win some significant prizes, believe it or not. We may talk more about that in the future, but that website again is rememberww2.org. Check it out. At the risk of sounding like your schoolmaster here and giving you more assignments, another ongoing effort that could really use your help is Stories Behind the Stars, with the goal of telling the stories of every single one of the more than 400,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II. I have a link for that for you online as well. But Stories Behind the Stars came to my mind on Veterans Day because I heard one of the stories behind one of those gold stars, and it really touched my heart. I was in Visalia, California, raising money for Central Valley Honor Flight to take veterans to their memorials in Washington, D.C., and a gentleman walked up to make a donation. He told me his name was Gabriel Garcia, and many years ago he had spent 4 years in the National Guard, but then he shared with me what had really motivated him to donate. He told me about his father, Jesse Garcia, who had been drafted into the Army at age 26 during World War II. One of Gabe's earliest memories is traveling from his native Arizona to Texas with his mother and brother to say goodbye to his father as he prepared to head overseas. On February 20, 1945, while fighting with the 10th Mountain Division's 86th Infantry Regiment in Italy, Jesse Garcia was hit by an enemy sniper and killed. He's buried at the Florence American Cemetery. Gabriel Garcia was 1.5 years old at the time. He and his brother grew up without their father, but with the knowledge that their dad, Jesse, lived up to the words that no doubt were quoted at Veterans Day observances all over America this week. Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. It's been said frequently that when it comes to our veterans, all gave some and some gave all. But one thing I believe wholeheartedly is that when we honor the all who gave some, we need to remember that they all were prepared to give all, the way Jesse Garcia did in Italy 76 years ago. Maybe you'd like to help honor his legacy by researching the rest of his story and submitting it to the Stories Behind the Stars project. You can find that at storiesbehindthestars.org, and again, I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. I know this is a much longer introduction than you're used to here on Hometown Heroes, but there's one more link online I want you to check out if you live near me in California, and it has to do with the story we're going to listen to today. It's information on a luncheon that will be free for veterans November 18th in Clovis, California, and it'll also be a chance for you to meet a few of the veterans whose stories you've heard here on Hometown Heroes. That's going to be at noon on November 18th, free for vets, $20 for the rest of us. All the info is at hometownheroesradio.com. And one of the veterans you'll get to meet is Niall Smith. He just turned 99 years old, but it's pretty miraculous he ever made it to 22. And there may be some future twists in his story that I would really love to see happen by the time he hits the century mark next November. I had the privilege of spending some time with Mr. Smith this last week at Fresno Christian School, where in addition to a standing ovation at the end of his talk, he was greeted by hundreds of students delivering a special musical message for this newly minted 99-year-old. Not sure if you could hear it there at the end, but that was Niall Smith jumping in with "Happy Birthday to Me" as the kids sang to him this week. It wasn't long until their jaws were dropping in amazement as they heard what he went through on April 12, 1944, and how in the world he survived. But before we get to that, let's hear about when Niall was the age some of those singing students are now, growing up near Decatur, Illinois.
Yeah, there's a small town called LaPlace, Illinois. And I was raised on a farm. Me and my dad were a farmer.
What'd you guys grow?
Corn, soybeans, wheat, clover for cows and everything.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Six brothers, no sisters.
Well, that's a lot of hands on the farm then.
Yeah. Of course, they're not all at the same time, but there's over three or four boys there to help do the farming and the work.
So it sounds like that occupied a lot of your time then growing up.
Yeah, it sure did. As far as the cows were concerned, or animals, you got to be there 7 days a week. Somebody has to be there to feed them and take care of them and all that.
So as you're going through high school and all that, were you dreaming of getting off the farm at some point and going somewhere else?
Not really. I was going to go to college. I graduated from high school in 1940. And I had a scholarship to a college in Carthage, Illinois. But then the war came along, so that was that.
Yeah, you had just celebrated your 19th birthday about a month before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember where you were when you found out about that?
Yes. You never forget a thing like that. Well, we were in a lay place there in the farmhouse in a dining room. It was about, or when we heard about it, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was sitting there listening to the radio. My dad was over in the corner in the rocking chair asleep, and the announcement came on. The Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor. All military personnel, if you're on leave or wherever you are, get back to your bases immediately. So I woke my dad up and told him, what? He couldn't believe it, see?
Did that hit you like a ton of bricks? Was that a pretty big deal?
Well, it's hard to believe. It was hard to believe, you know. So then I went into service in January of 42. I didn't want to be in the Army, really, because, you know, they had a lot of time on the ground and everything. So either the Air Force or the Navy. So I enlisted in the Air Force.
How many of your brothers ended up serving in the war?
Two others during the war. Altogether, there were five of us brothers that had been in the service.
Wow.
Four of us had retired from the service.
How many years were you in?
22 years. 20 months and 6 days.
Not too many veterans I get to interview who served in both World War II and the Vietnam War, but that's the case for Niall. We're going to hear about that. And you mentioned the other brothers that were in World War II. Did they make it home as well?
Yeah, everybody made it home.
You had quite the odds to beat to make it home yourself. We're going to get to that. But let's talk about those early days in the Army Air Corps.
I wanted to be a pilot, but at that time you got to have education. I think now it's 4 years. But at that time, it was 2 years. So I knew I couldn't be a pilot. So I said, well, I'll be a gunner or something like that, be on an air crew. At the time I applied, that was all filled up, so I couldn't get that. So I ended up being a mechanic. I went to mechanic school.
Little did you know what was ahead of you. Little did you know some of the adventures you would have, the close calls you would have, that it wasn't just medals you brought home from the war. You brought home something that's lasted a lot longer and been a lot more important to you. We'll get to that before we're done. But when you say a mechanic, what did that mean you were responsible for, and how much responsibility did you feel?
Of course, we didn't know what kind of planes we were going to be or working on or assigned to. Then, we found out it was going to be B-17s. There was about five men on a ground crew. There's always a crew chief, assistant crew chief, and then two or three other guys. You start out just ground crew, but I ended up being assistant crew chief. Of course, that takes several years to get up to that. But it's B-17s. And our group was formed, the 96 bomb group was formed in Walla Walla, Washington. And our commander at that time was Archie J. Olds. He was a colonel. He was later on, after the war and everything, he was in charge of 15th Air Force at March Air Force Base. He was a general.
From going on the farm with your brothers to at these different bases with all these guys from all over the country, was that a bit of an eye-opener for you?
Oh, yeah. Started out in Walla Walla, Washington, was there a month. Rapid City, South Dakota for a month. Pocatello, Idaho for 2 months, I think. And then we got on a train and we went clear down around through California thing to Paoli, Texas. That base was built, or just finished building it. And we were there about 3.5 months, and they were continuing the training to go overseas. We didn't know where we'd go, but ended up being England.
The B-17, to be responsible for it operating the way it needs to, I mean, you've got men's lives in your hands every time that plane goes up, don't
you? That's right. Been some nights we worked all night to make sure it's right or, you know, get something done so that they could have the plane for the next day.
Was there part of that when you go through all your checks and make sure this is operating right and this is moving right and that's running right? Was there one part of that that gave you the most trouble or that was the hardest to make sure it was doing what it was supposed to do?
Probably the hardest thing was getting there, like when you changed an engine. And then you've got to put all the accessories like carburetor and fuel pump and everything else on the new engine, transfer that over and then hang the thing and get it adjusted to the right RPM and make sure that everything is working like it's supposed to work.
Because if it's not, that could cost some people their lives.
Well, that's right. That engine could quit or go out.
So was that fulfilling work for you?
Well, it was at the time, you know. I mean, sure. Just made sure you did the job right. I remember during the war, like in England, lots of nights we were working nighttime. We didn't have big floodlights and everything else. There's a war going on. We used flashlights. You hear a plane overhead, you turn the light out. Because they said that a plane from 10,000 feet can see a cigarette on the ground.
Wow. Sounds pretty tense.
Yeah, lots of night.
What about the journey over to England? Was that an adventure for you?
Oh, yeah. We got on the train at Paoli up through Fort Worth and Dallas. And at that time, the space between Dallas and Fort Worth, there might have been 20 miles or so. No people. But now it's all one big city. Anyway, then we went up to New York, and we left from Pier 50 on the Queen Elizabeth, the first Queen Elizabeth. And right beside where the Queen Elizabeth was, here was the Normandy lying on its side. Somebody had sabotaged it, and it burned.
That's encouraging.
So, yeah. So then we got on the ship, and it took us 6 days to go across. They changed course every 7 minutes, zigzag. And the only people that knew the course was the captain and the navigator. They did that because of the subs. 15,000, 18,000 troops on that one ship, 24 hours in the stateroom, 24 hours on deck. A stateroom that would normally have maybe two or three or four people, here's maybe 18 people assigned to that one room, about four high, you know. I know the first night I went out, had to go out on deck, it started raining. So what do you do then? You pick up all your stuff and go and get in a lounge someplace.
Do you remember what it felt like emotionally? I mean, were you concerned that you might not see America again?
Well, not really. You know, young people, they're full of energy and they don't think about things like that. They just want to get in the middle of everything and they don't think about dying. I mean, you don't think about it until it actually happens, or you know, something happens, and you think you might.
And before you went over there, did you think that your job was going to be a pretty safe job, comparatively speaking?
Well, yeah, but England was getting bombed too. See, and the first night we were in England, our base got bombed.
Wow! Welcome to the war.
And we hadn't had any. We didn't have any shelters or anything else. Wasn't anything set up as a new base, see? Here was guys diving through hedges to be in a ditch, get in a ditch, stuff like that.
Where'd you go?
I just found a low spot and got in it. But there wasn't anybody killed or anything.
But it got your attention.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how old were you?
Well, I'd be 20, I guess, 19 or 20. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So then your bombers start flying their missions. And tell us what your duty was like those first few weeks and months that you were over there.
Well, we had to get them ready. If they came back, either bomb damage or engine out, something like that, we'd change an engine overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And that would take maybe 6-8 hours. And we heard that the Germans could change an engine in 15 minutes. They had all quick disconnects and everything else. We didn't. We had hoses and clamps and, you know, all kind of stuff. Anyway, you just keep them ready. And they always called. They said they need so many planes. We got to have so many planes. So there's lots of times we worked all night, you know, to get one ready. Even changing outer wing panels and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. How did the pilots and the crews of those bombers treat you?
They treated us good, and they depended on us, too. Like the original pilots that we took over there, I mean, they knew what was going on, and they knew that, or they depended on us, and they got to know the ground crew and all that, because you can't have a plane, something happening on the flight. So, yeah, they appreciated it.
And you mentioned having to fix damaged engines or patch up damaged planes. Was that a pretty frequent occurrence? I mean, was it rare for a group of bombers to come back unscathed?
It was rare for them to, very rare for them to come back unscathed until about, it had to be in 44 before the P-51s got over there to where they could go all the way on the mission.
With as escort, yeah.
Right, as escort. Up to that time, they could only go halfway, like a P-47, they go halfway and they have to turn around. Then you're at the mercy, and here's a German fighter sitting out there waiting, see? So when they came back, there was holes. Of course, you had sheet metal men. That was their job. There was holes. There was half a tail shot off, you know, and stuff like that. So there was lots of damage, and we knew that that's how it would be. It would fly it almost.
Did you ever look at a plane and say, I don't know how that one made it back?
Yeah, yeah. We had one. It wasn't our plane. Let's see. Part of the tail was gone. Two engines were out. The third one was going out. So actually, he only had about one engine, one and a half engine. And he made it back. And when it landed, the gear gave out, and he just slid, you know. I don't know how they made it back. There were six guys wounded, and they shot several fighters down. See, that plane had to leave the formation. Something was wrong. They had to leave the formation and come back on their own. And, of course, here's these fighters. They jumped right on them. And the pilot, they said if it hadn't been for the pilot, they wouldn't have made it, because he would twist that plane around so that they'd have to line up on a tail or something. And he twisted sideways so everybody could get a shot at him.
Wow.
But there were six guys wounded, maybe one killed. But anyway, they made it back. I don't know how.
And you said that wasn't one of your planes, so it makes me wonder, how many planes were you and your crew responsible for?
Well, we were just responsible for the one plane.
That one
Our
plane.
Our plane, yeah.
So you had the same pilot and crew to deal with for quite a while until they went
That's
back
right.
to the States?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And the original crews, we got to know pretty well, you know. By the time they rotated or were gone, well, then you get new crews.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we're going to hear about what Niall Smith did to help save the lives of members of a bomber crew he barely knew. And if you'd like to meet Mr. Smith and hear him tell his story in person, he'll be one of those veterans with me at a special lunch this coming Thursday, November 18th in Clovis, California. I've got the information on that online for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this.